And I can't help but feel a little bit insulted.
I mean, poor Rabbi Tendler just announced to me we attend 45 out of the next 50 shop purses. We get $100 if you get there by
Baruch. That means you get overspaced by 15 minutes.
You look much younger.
And we get $500.
Yeah, nice.
You're here until this person shows up and I'll move. It's there here.
Thank you. Well, okay, Rabbi Sai, singing our proofs of Jewish history.
Jewish history tonight?
By the way, I'm going to be at Forest Richard meet this week also again, so I'm going to be here tomorrow night, Tuesday, instead of Wednesday.
Is that permission?
No, it's on a week-to-week basis. Now, there are a couple of things I wanted to cover tonight, at the time in the period of the Gaonim. First of all, of course, during the period of the Gaonim, did we speak about Rabbanan Saburai last week?
A little bit, yeah.
We did, right? We mentioned about Rabbanan
Saburai. Yeah, we did. We just had a small period of time where they kind of just editing on.
Yeah. Well. And we mentioned the dangerous approach towards learning Talmud, right?
The what? Yeah,
we did. We did, right?
Definitely did.
Yeah, okay. So,
The radical approach
to Talmud study.
Yeah?
I thought we mentioned
it. What's that? Well, the one with the layers where they thought that things were done at different times? Where something's uncited? Or that one?
We didn't mention
that?
What?
Okay,
I thought we did. So after the time of Rabbanan Saburai, we have the Gaonim. And the Gaonim will go on for about 500 years or so. Now, one of the first things, one of the main things which happened, and I should say, the period of the Gaonim begins around the year 475 or so, and goes on, actually after Rabbanan Saburai, begins around the year 500, 550, and goes on to the year 1000, 1050 or so. So the a couple of major things which happened, first of all, are that the Muslims come on the scene. Muhammad comes on the scene in the 630s, and Muhammad took a lot of his original religion from the Jews, right? A lot of it was fasting. Yom Kippur was even part of it early on. So they had a lot of, Muslim religion was copycat religion, copied from the Jews, from the Christians. So a lot of elements were initially Jewish, but eventually Muhammad soured on the Jews because the Jews were not converting as he anticipated they would, and therefore he got upset with them and started killing them. So he didn't actually go on a campaign to annihilate the Jews, but he did expel all the Jews from Saudi Arabia, whatever it was called at the time, Arabia. So that's why to this day there are no Jews, at least that we know of, living in the area of Saudi Arabia. Now in Yemen, there and Aden, which are the southern tip of Arabia, there are plenty of Jews. As a matter of fact, there was a tradition that there was even once a Jewish king in Yemen many thousands of years ago. But that is not to be confused with Arabia. Arabia starts north of that. We're talking about specifically the area around Mecca and Medina, where the Muslim sense of religion was. Nobody, no Jews, no Christians were allowed to be in that area. Of course, to this very day, as you know, Muslims are not allowed in the city of Mecca. They're not allowed there. Just no other. Generally speaking, wherever the Muslims were, they were more tolerant of the Jews than the Christians. As bad as the Muslims were, they were still better tolerant. More accepting of the Jews than the Christians. So as bad as the Muslims were, Jews were still better off than the Muslims, which is why Jews flourished in Babel. Some exceptions over time. As a matter of fact, I think the first place where they made Jews wear yellow badges was in Iraq, in Babel, I forget which year it is, sometimes in the 700s. No, but these are yellow badges, the four stars. But they were better off generally than under the Christians, so they always were enthusiastic when the Muslims took over. For example, in Spain, in the 700s, the Muslims conquered Spain from the Christians, and that was considered to be a good thing. And from that time on, we have the golden age of Spanish Jewry, which really took place under Muslim rule, coming to its height in the 1000s, sometime later in history. We'll come back to that, of course, when we get to it. A couple of other things, the Gaonim were very, very forward-thinking people. They really tried to get very positive things enacted in Klal Yisrael. One of the things, for example, which they tried to enact, which was ultimately not successful, it was ultimately a failure, for, at least among Ashkenazic Jews, was they made a takana that if a wife demands a divorce because she feels, she claims she cannot live with her husband any longer, that basin compels the husband to give the wife a divorce. Now this is a very powerful tool, because it meant that any wife could really go to basin and demand a divorce from her husband. And the basin would then have the right to beat that person until he actually gave that divorce. That was in the year 645. Reb Rava the Gona Pumpadisa made a takana together with Reb Huna the Gona Psura that a woman should be given an immediate divorce if she refused to live with her husband. However, later on in Jewish history, in the 1100s, along came a great scholar named Rabbeinu Tam. And Rabbeinu Tam rejected this piece of Gaonic legislation. Rabbeinu Tam said that if a woman says that she no longer live with her husband, we suspect that she really is trying. She's decided she wants to go live with somebody else, and she's not being sincere. And therefore, we don't compel the husband to give a guest on that basis. Yeah.
What was the need that brought about that change?
We don't know for sure, but I think that the idea was that they felt that this was in the spirit of what Chazal, you know, the Chazal instituted the ksuva for a woman as a safeguard for protection that is in turn for divorce, and you have to pay ksuva. So this is also for the protection of women. They actually wanted women to be able to not be subject to husbands which were not to their liking.
Did they see there was abuse?
I imagine so. We don't know exactly why they made the takana, but obviously the takana was made because of some necessary reason at the time. So Rabbeinu Tam came along and said it's not true. So to this very day, we have this problem, which is we need to abide by the psak of Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam was one of the great giants of the psak. So therefore, if he said you can't compel a divorce, and a divorce which is compelled in the absence of halachic reasons to compel it is not a valid divorce. So therefore, this is one of the major, major headaches in contemporary halacha. In order to compel a husband to divorce, you have to have valid grounds. The fact that the wife doesn't want to live with him anymore in halacha is an insufficient basis for divorce. This is a very, very tough halacha. We'd be much better off, I think, if the halacha had gone in accordance with the Gaonim. But we don't have the power in our day and age to say, well, suffering on Rabbeinu Tam. There have been several movements to this effect. There was this modern Orthodox rabbi in Israel, Rabbi Riskin, who wrote an entire book advocating the overturn of Rabbeinu Tam's standard. But we don't, it really is hard to do. Yes.
I love that. Couldn't it possibly lead to a fact if my wife doesn't want to live with me anymore at that point, and that's obviously not grounds for a get. At that point, at a certain point, that's going to be very hard on me too.
Yeah.
So at that point, it could just be a stepping stone to something else. Is that
true? But what happens is that in our day and age, it's probably the problem which has developed is over our baby time issue, is that husbands hold out for large sums of money from their wives in order to grant divorces. Since Basin can't compel them to get divorced. So therefore they hold out until such time as, you know, they get what they want. So for example, you know, we have this concept called a ksuva, right?
Sure.
Which means that if a woman gets divorced, she should really be getting a certain degree, certain settlements, right? It's almost impossible to collect them nowadays. Because by the time the husband, unless, you know, it's a really amicable divorce, right, which is not necessarily usually the case. So otherwise the husband will say, you know what, if you want a ksuba, I'm not divorcing you. And she's stuck. There was just a case yesterday in Israel where a woman who was an aguna, she was refused a divorce by her husband for 18 years.
Wow.
She's suing the government for 4.5 million shekels or something for not facilitating her divorce. Now, this is a much, relatively speaking, in Israel, this is not as bad as in America. Because in Israel, there is a court system which actually can enforce certain types of penalties if they do decide the divorce is warranted. Now, for example, Tito Yezer, who was one of the great posts, I'm just giving this as a wild example, okay? He said, what happens if a husband shoots at his wife? Right, he takes a shot and he misses. So Tito Yezer says, that's valid grounds for divorce. Whereas the wife can sue in... the wife can sue in basis of divorce on the basis of this husband is clearly not a good fit. So that case, actually, in Israel, a basis can throw you in jail if you refuse to give a divorce. They can take away your driver's license, they can throw you in jail, they can garnish your wages, they can do all sorts of nasty things to you.
And driver's license can throw you
out. Yeah. So, it's in Israel, it is. So, I think in America also it would be a big thing. Anyway, but in America, of course, we don't have any of those powers. And we also have the separation of church and state, which complicates things even further. So we are not able, really, in America, to compel a husband to give a divorce, except by social pressure.
Don't have certain secret guys that, someone's telling a lady does it.
Yeah, but that's not so simple. In other words, if they can't say to the guy, we're going to beat you up unless you give a divorce.
Right.
Because then you're really compelling him to give a divorce, and the divorce is not a valid thing.
Right.
You have to beat him up and ask questions later. But only if it's a case in which divorce is warranted. Not a case in which you decide that you want the guy to give a divorce.
Well, that's the point of the get game, right?
I imagine that that's the point, I'm saying that they can't say we're now beating you up until you give a wife again.
Why is it
beat
so hard to, what do you say, show that it's legitimate grounds for divorce? Can we say, the wife is miserable, and
that's not enough.
Obviously has some problem, psychological problem, he's refusing again.
Has to be abusive. Has to be documented abusive, yeah. That is one of the major problems of Golus, is this issue, if not the most major problem.
Wow.
Not only that, what exists, since there is no universal system of courts in Chutz Laretz, so what one court might declare to be a valid reason to divorce, another court might declare is not a valid reason. And there could be all sorts of nasty things going on. So that actually is a major, major problem today, the issue of divorce in Jewish law. But if we abided by the Gaonim, it wouldn't have been a problem. Now, generally speaking, the Rishonim, like Rabbeinu Tam, felt they could argue on the Gaonim. Another classic example is that the Gaonim held that nightfall is adjusted for time, for time of year and for latitude and longitude about 15 to 18 minutes after sunset. That's nightfall. That, what happened, Rabbeinu Tam came along and said, no. It's much later than that. It's 72 minutes adjusted for latitude and longitude and all that after sunset. So you see that the Rishonim, like Rabbeinu Tam, argued very often on the Gaonim. A case in which the Gaonim made a takana, another progressive, so to speak, takana, which the Gaonim made, which is kept to this day, is that according to the Gemara, the only time, according to the strict letter of the law and Gemara, the only time you can collect from your debtor property is if that property is real estate, not if it is metalpulin. I should say copy that he sold. That's what I meant to say. But let's say I borrowed from you $500, right? And now I default on the loan. So the halacha is you can go to any real estate which I own at the time of the loan and collect from there. But you can't go and collect metalpulin, meaning movable objects which I sold, right? So if I sold the shirt off my back, you can't go and take that shirt away from that person, right? So along came, and the same thing with the ksuba of a woman. If a woman is supposed to get a ksuba and her husband sold all his movable items and it was not linked to real estate, then she's up the creek. So the Gaonim came and they said, for the ksuba of a woman can acquire her ksuba, can collect the ksuba, not just from real estate which her husband possessed and sold, but even from movable objects which her husband possessed at the time that he wrote the ksuba and then later sold them. This is also another forward piece of legislation which the Gaonim, legislation which the Gaonim came up with. I once had a debate, I think I told this, mentioned this in Shia, but not recently. I once had a debate, a public debate many years ago with Rabbi Dov Linzer. Ooh. Rabbi Dov Linzer is the head of the extreme left-wing, quote-unquote, yeshiva in Orthodoxy, called Chovevei Torah, which is a radical, heretical type yeshiva in Manhattan. The,
Abby White?
Abby White is yeshiva, right. So the
hang on. Rabbi, who was this guy? What's his name?
Dov Linzer.
And then Orthodoxy, or you just said yeshiva?
They call it open Orthodox.
Open Orthodox.
Oh!
Does
it also?
What?
Open Orthodox.
They probably have a rabbi from Chovevei Torah. Yeah.
Why did his Shulchan Aruch like? Is it like Shulchan Aruch today or really?
Liberal interpretation of the Torah.
So
now? What?
So now?
What do you mean?
I don't know.
What do you mean?
what do you mean liberal interpretation?
You know, not really much faith for interpretation.
Oh, there's lots of interpretation. If you're willing to distort things, there's plenty of interpretation. A lot of this I'm saying just to annoy Michael here. But in any event, Rabbi Linzer, the Rosh Hashiva, is a fine fellow, is a big time with Chacham, just has some improper views on various different things. So we had a debate, and first we're going to debate how to approach, how to analyze a sugya. Like how to analyze, we're going to do the sugya, beginning of Kiddushin, which talks about all the conceptual analysis of Kiddushin. So he uses the layers approach to Gemara. So I said, listen, Rabbi Linzer, if we debate this, I'm going to have to say you're not because in public. So you're not going to be happy about that. So we decided to debate something else. Yeah.
Is it the layers? What is it? She's asked.
Yeah.
What?
How many guys were here last week when I spoke about this? Nobody? Just Yossi remember?
About what?
What?
Yeah. What?
Wait,
what
are you talking about? About what?
There's a new approach towards learning Gemara. I'm sorry, Yossi, I'm sorry, Josh. There's a new approach towards learning Gemara called Rivadim. Rivadim means literally layers. Okay, what it means, the assumption of the layers approach, or the Rivadim approach, is that the final layer of the Gemara, the sum of the Gemara, was an idiot. In other words, the person who wrote, put together the Gemara, stitched together various different statements, he wasn't too bright. And we're able to go back and assess the statements which he stitched together on our own. In other words, we can go back and say, well, we understand Abaye better than Mr. Sum of the Gemara. Sum of the Gemara meaning the Gemara without attribution. That's the Rivadim approach. We unpeel the layers and get back to the original meaning of the Gemaras in question.
Is it, I thought that the Rabbanim was just like differentiating which part of the Gemara is what?
Yeah, but no, there's more, it's agendized though. It was a
there's an agenda of coming with it.
Yeah.
I see.
Agenda,
I didn't know.
Yeah, that was originated by this system by David Weissel.
I think it was Bar Ilan thing, no?
No, David Weissel lived in Pinchas Haman and Bar Ilan popularized it, and is trying to popularize in Israel. But it's originally to David Weissel Livni who developed it while at JTS in New York. So in any event, then what you would do in this case of Kiddushin, according to this approach, is you try and ascertain what parts of the law of Kiddushin are authentically Jewish, what parts come from Hammurabi's codes, what part came from the rabbis just tacked on. You know, you peel back the layers in order to get at the origin.
Deconstructionism. But I mean reconstruction with Jews, they do it with Chumash.
What?
The reconstruction is used with Chumash.
Right, so you deconstruct the Talmud. What?
You think parts right from Hammurabi's Torah?
Okay. You have to speak to Rabbi Linzer about it, because we never got into detail, but that's what he
Why did they choose you to do this debate? Like, you were in this debate. Why?
What?
Why you were in this debate? You were like the one in this debate.
This actually paid very well, this debate.
Where is it all?
I'm saying why do you do that? I mean, why do they choose? Like, what is their expertise that they... Like, what...
Who are you? Who are you? Who
are you, man?
How am I supposed to answer that question?
My brain is not putting out what I want to say.
What was that problem?
I mean, I was free. They didn't call me. I don't know who these people are. Some debate. They didn't invite me.
It was in Lincoln Square Synagogue about 6 years ago, and I was telling my family with the rabbi, so...
I'm saying, like, if you have a barrel of wine, you get a cheers, but like, don't have me cheers because he does history. So.
He's really out to get me tonight.
Never mind.
Never mind.
What were your SAT scores?
So,
they have no one better. Like, okay, Beckhoff. Okay, call that. What's his name? Beckhoff? Okay, I got
it. He'll bring his son. He's cute.
He's anyway.
Anyway, so the actual topic which we end up debating, who's heard this from me before? Anybody here? No? The actual topic we ended up debating was whether the issue of entering a mosque in Halacha, is that psak, the psak read by various different authorities, a function of their halachic methodology or a function of their social prejudice? So basically you have a machloket between the Tzitz Eliezer and Rav Avadia Yosef. The Tzitz Eliezer says you're forbidden to enter a mosque. Rav Avadia Yosef says you're allowed to enter a mosque. So what Rabbi Linzer asserted, this by the way is all going to come back to what we're talking about tonight. Believe me, we're getting there. So Rabbi Linzer asserted that the Tzitz Eliezer passed as forbidden to enter a mosque because He, although he was born in Israel, he is an Ashkenazi Jew, and therefore he comes from a heritage which dislikes Christians, and therefore they extrapolate from their attitude towards Christians, which, of course, is not permitted to enter a church, and they extrapolate from that, and they decide that they're not allowed to enter a mosque as well. Whereas Rav Yosef, who comes from a Sephardic heritage, has a more benevolent attitude towards Muslims, and therefore, as a result, he permits entering into a mosque.
Isn't it like a talent thing?
Sorry?
Isn't it a talent thing, sort of the social thing? The talent there?
What about the soul guy?
The toilet, isn't it the problem, instead of social connotation?
Well, we're not, we're talking about a mosque, because there's nobody hanging in the mosque.
That's what I'm saying.
Yes, that was the question.
So
he came.
Why bring his charity in?
No, because he was saying that Tzitz Eliezer's bias is what led him to associate all foreign religions, lump them together, and therefore he said, just like now outside their church, you know, where the guy is hanging, you're not allowed to enter into a mosque, even though there's nobody hanging there. Okay? So my contention was that, no, there's a very simple, straightforward methodology of stock issue. The Tzitz Eliezer says, we have a run. The Ran is a Rishon. The Ran says you're not allowed to go into a mosque. He says, maybe he'll say, well, Islam is not a Bodhisattva. Maybe, he says, but this veneration that they give Muhammad is much too much over the top, and therefore it's like a Bodhisattva, therefore you should not allow to enter a mosque. They don't really, they really worship him as opposed to really treating him like a prophet. That was his perspective.
So Avadia ben Yosef was just saying that...
Well, I didn't get to him yet. One second. Rav Avadia Yosef says, however, he says, listen, whatever the Ram says is nice, but the Rambam and Shulchan Aruch don't say anything. So our final authorities are Rambam, Shulchan Aruch. Rambam doesn't say it's written to enter a mosque. On the contrary, the Rambam says, Islam is not a Bodhisattva. So the Shulchan Aruch doesn't say it can't enter a mosque, so therefore, why shouldn't you be allowed to enter a mosque? So the methodology issue. The Rambam, Sitali has told, if you have a Rishon who weighs in on a topic, even if it's not one of the, you know, first line major poskim like the Rambam or the Shulchan Aruch, we poskim like that Rishon. Whereas Rav Yosef holds, no, we're not bound to poskim by Rishonim unless it appears in the, so to speak, the top tier, right? If you have the Rambam and Shulchan Aruch saying something, then you're bound by that. Otherwise, you're not bound by that. Okay, so therefore, he says, you know, since none, Rambam and Shulchan Aruch are not going to think about you, you're allowed to enter a mosque. What do you want to ask?
The church factor is that there's, you know, a dead guy hanging up there, and there's also crosses everywhere, so you might make the mistake, tie your shoe, and you make a mistake of bowing to
to that cross, to that crucifix, or to that dead guy. In the mosque, there's no problem like that. There's no dead guy, there's no crosses, there's no imagery that you might make a mistake
about. See, it's interesting, but neither of them address that issue. Mm-hmm. In other words, neither of them approach it from the issue of you might, the cross.
Right.
They approach it from the issue of Islam, the nature of Islam. Mm-hmm. Okay? So that was our issue. And we got into a whole debate as to whether, now, how a post-game approach an issue. Now, of course, the danger in Rabbi Linz's approach is that if every stock is based on cultural bias, well, it's very easy to overturn a stock, right? All you have to do is identify the bias, explain why the bias is improper, and then, it's not very simple. The stock is invalidated, right? It's a great tool. So in the middle of our, in the course of our conversation about the topic, Rabbi Linzer said the following. He gave an example of his approach. Another example of the approach. He says, we have a machlokas between the Sfaradim and Ashkenazim. Can women make a bracha on mitzvah saseh shazman groma? On mitzvah saseh, which are time-bound. So the Rambam holds not allowed to, and therefore Sfaradim women do not make brachas on mitzvah saseh shazman groma, like lulav and so on and so forth. The Ashkenazim hold that they are allowed to. Therefore, Ashkenazi women do make bracha, lulav, etc., etc. Now, Leishev Vosukha, now Sephardi women also won't make. Right, because it's mitzvah on grama. Now, the actual issue, as far as the poskim is concerned, is that the places hold, the Beit Tam holds, is that when you say Ashrek Hashem Tzav Tivanu, you're not talking about your personal obligation. Right? You're talking about Klai Yisrael's obligation. Right? Klai Yisrael's obliged to pick up a lulav and to sit in a sukkah. Whether you as an individual are or not is not relevant. Right? Since Klai Yisrael's obliged, therefore you can make a bracha. And therefore a woman can make the bracha as well. Whereas the Rambam holds, you can only say Asher Hashem Tzav Tivanu if you are actually required to do the mitzvah. If you're not required to do the mitzvah, then you can't say Asher Kishama Sovet Sivonu, so therefore you can't make the bracha.
Then why does it say us Islam
and wrong? Us, well, us means us males. That's what it means according to the Rambam. Us males who are obligated. So the way Rabbi Linzer explained the Machlokas is as follows. He said, Rabbeinu Tam lived in...
Yes, but you're including yourself.
Yeah, okay, including yourself with other males. Rabbeinu,
but if you're not doing it, if you're not doing it, and the Rambam must be wrong, because he says even if you're not going into the sukkah, you have to.
Okay, we'll discuss it later. Okay, we'll discuss it later on the way home. We'll argue it out. Okay, now, and we will. Don't worry about that. Rabbi Linzer said that Rabbeinu Tam lived in the more enlightened, progressive, forward-thinking Christian Northern Europe, whereas Rabbi Rambam lived in the more backward, regressive, misogynistic Egypt, Northern Africa. So therefore, Rabbeinu Tam, being enlightened and progressive, is more of a feminist. So he let women make brachas on Mitzvah Seshos Magrama, whereas the Rambam, being, you know, a conservative, reactionary, was anti-women, he did not let women make brachas on mitzvah seishas magrama. So I said to him, I said, Rabbi Linzer, Rabbeinu Tam is responsible for the single piece of legislation which is most anti-women, which we possess, which we were talking about a few minutes ago, which is that a woman can't demand a get just because she doesn't want to live with her husband anymore. So if Rabbeinu Tam was such a forward, enlightened, feminist kind of scholar, so we should have not have enacted this law, which would totally undermine the status of a woman in demanding a divorce.
What did he say?
What?
Did he swallow his tongue?
I don't remember what he said. I conveniently blotted out of my memory when he said that, but it wasn't anything memorable, otherwise. Yeah.
All right, doesn't he see the danger of, interpreting or looking at halakha and or deciding the stuff because of, cultural... context of that time, because it's just our interpretation of that context anyway, which can change, it can change over time.
He embraces that danger. That's what he wants to do.
So it's not even the material that is changing, it's just our you have two variables now going on. You have he is dead and our interpretation of what was dead, and you working with both of these things at the same time. I mean, that's like Esker, you know, you can't say
nothing
you can do.
You can have lots of fun.
Well, that's for sure, but like,
I don't. Like, what's the math mean? That's how you look at it? Or you look at the math, okay, it's another one. Is he actually saying 40 women should make a bracha, or what's his...
anybody actually has the courage to come out and say explicitly as of yet, but yes, that would be the conclusion. So it's now North America, where we're more enlightened, you know, we understand that women have more, mental capacity and interest in being, serving God, so yeah, we would allow them.
So there's an action, like, a math meaner. Yeah.
Right. They haven't come out and pronounced enough communists. The eventual agenda is to have women Orthodox rabbis. That's what's eventually going to happen, but they're taking it stage by stage.
What's the defense for using these principles in ethics? Where do they derive from? He's using, like feminism and advancement things to override...
I mean, where do we find in Orthodoxy itself?
Yeah.
In Orthodox tradition?
Yeah.
I don't think that bothers them. They don't see a need for validation within tradition.
That's the thing, history progresses, we progress beyond Torah.
As long as they retain the core, which is the Gimli Karim, so you've been to the Rambam, and maybe even not that, because some of the open Orthodox scholars reject the concept of the 13 principles, but whatever there is, then we can do whatever we want with the rest of it.
So by that, what's different than Reform, or
what
all these other
groups? Well, Reform doesn't believe in halacha at all, right? So conservative purported too recently to believe in halacha, although they didn't really. So, but Orthodox, as Orthodox Jews, they say that we do believe in halacha. It's just that they have an open way of approaching halacha, and
it's the same thing.
No. I'm not saying the same thing.
I'm doing the same thing.
But they wouldn't take it as far. Because
new thing for all the country?
Open Orthodoxy.
Are there any differences between that and JTF 80 years ago?
No, very few differences.
What's JTF?
The conservative. The major difference, if there is a difference, is that the conservatives 80 years ago were pure Litvak, and they're more touchy-feely, kind of guys.
Bali
Tshuva. What? Something like Bali Tshuva, right. So they're not as, the Litvak were much more free to discard anything they found to not appeal to pure scholarship, whereas these guys, they have some sentiment to them.
Do you think they serve a potential important role in...
No. They serve no need. It's not true. If you want a whipping bag like we do tonight, so then they've been very important and funny for us. But other than that, in the positive sense, I don't think they serve any positive need.
And just as an example, they're obviously extremely important. How do you react to this? I know someone who's going to pursue Smichel there next fall. There's a girl from my high school who's not really interested in Judaism. She just doesn't feel comfortable in Jewish communities. This guy is like, he's really actually like pure Orthodox. He disagrees with certain things that he thinks is a good fit for him. But she said to him, I'm not really interested in Judaism, but I would come to your shul. Just in general, I mean, they might do certain things that are dangerous, but they're more interested in reaching out to people or just making Jews feel more welcome in general.
I don't know if that's true, but I think you have lots of YU rabbis who are almost in the same place. And they're not part of the, not part of this new, movement, so to speak. So I'm not sure that's the case. If any, they basically cut the extreme right wing off of YU and took it further left. Extreme left wing off of YU and took it further left. Okay? So that is as far as the Takana Sagonim goes. The Takana Sagonim, as I said, there's just one, using the Chovei Torah lingo, they were progressive feministic kind of guys, and they made these Takanos for the benefit of women. But later on, the Rishonim argued on these Takanos, and some of them actually rejected. Now, the second Takana Sagonim, which we mentioned, which is one of that nowadays, even if a husband sells off movable objects, they still remain under lien for the wife's ksuba. That was never rejected. The first one, however, as I said, was rejected by Rabbeinu Tam. Another development in the time of Gonim was, which I want to talk about, was the machlokas between Rabbi Sadi Gon and Rabbi Avram ben Meir. Rabbi Avram ben Meir was the Rosh Yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael. Rabbi Sadi Gon was the Rosh Yeshiva, was one of the Rosh Yeshiva in Bavel. They had in the year 922. Did I mention this already? Anybody remember this calendar issue? No. They had in the year 922 a major machlokas in which Klai Yisrael kept Pesach on two different days. In other words, those who followed Rabbi Aaron ben Meir.
In Jewish history, Shiv were for Motzei Shabbos.
Oh yeah, the Basher Shabbos for this. Okay, so Rabbi Aaron ben Meir was Rosh Shiva in Tveria, and Rabbi Sadi Gon was Rosh Shiva in Bavel, and they had a difference of opinion as to when Rosh Hashanah should be. And that year, Rosh Hashanah was kept in Israel on a Tuesday, and in Bavel on a Thursday. And Pesach that year also was different days. And there was a tremendous, tremendous controversy in Orthodox Judaism. Basically a risk in Orthodox Judaism. Now that, the way it worked in the old days, that, you know, nowadays every September, new calendars for the coming Jewish year pop up, right? They pick new calendars, you know, the Jerusalem orphanage, or as a Torah, or, you ever wonder how those calendars come about? Who sits down and makes the calendar for the next year? I've always wondered how they all know exactly what to do.
They just continue writing down the days.
Yeah, but there's a 19-year cycle. They have to know which year the cycle is, and there are other rules which affect it as well.
Yeah, so they know
what the last. Okay, happened to be the last time there was a controversy was in terms of the Chasam Sefer. The Chasam Sefer actually was an issue as to when Rosh Hashanah should be, but it seems like, and that's over 150 years ago. Seems like everybody since the Chasam Sefer put things straight, and that was that. But in any event, what it used to be in the old days, in the 900s, was that every Hoshana Rabbah, the Rosh Yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael, would go up to the Mount of Olives in Yerushalayim and announce, this is the schedule for the coming year. Now, why in Hoshana Rabbah? Because the two Jewish months which fluctuate in days are Cheshvan and Kislev, this month and next month. Sometimes they're both 29 days, sometimes they're both 30, normally it's 29-30. Okay? So the Rosh Yeshiva would get up and announce what Cheshvan and Kislev would be. Now, of course, that means even before Rosh Hashanah comes about, there's going to be a difference for Pesach, right? Because it's between Sukkot and Pesach that these months take place. Now, what determines this issue is when next Rosh Hashanah is going to be, because we don't make Rosh Hashanah on a Sunday, Wednesday, or Friday, right? The first day of Hoshana can't come out Sunday, Wednesday, Friday, because then we would have Hoshana Rabbah come out on Friday, or Yom Kippur come out on a Sunday or a Friday, and we don't want any of those three things to happen. So therefore, Hoshana can't come out on those days. Also, there's Alokha, because it'd be very inconvenient for the Jewish people. There is the principle that
you... What if it comes out on a Friday?
Yom Kippur or Hoshana Rabbah?
Yom Kippur.
Then it became on Friday?
It'd be fasting the beginning of the Shabbos.
How are you going to prepare for Shabbos? In the answer, you can make Erev Tashir and prepare for Shabbos. How are you going to prepare for Shabbos from Yom Kippur?
Well,
You fast on Shabbos.
Not if the next day is Shabbos. That's why you don't get my Shabbos on the same day. Not if it still comes down Friday.
That means that you could do Erev Tov Shivan.
No, you can't. You can't do it.
And you get to cook on Yom Kippur.
Believe me, you can't. You can't do Erev Tov Shivan. You know, I know you see Manhattan, which would be perfect for you. Anyway, there's also another halacha, which is that if the Molad on the day was supposed to be Rosh Hashanah, in other words, the beginning of the new lunar cycle, you know, there's a lot of mistakes about this that people don't know. Even the art school sitter has a very basic and blatant error about this. Somebody, is there an art school sitter in here?
Yeah.
Where is the art school sitter? Give me this. I saw the mistake in the linear sitter. I don't know if it's in here. The interlinear sitter. I assume it's in here too. At least I hope so.
You actually hope it's not. For the
purpose
of the
sheer,
you hope it is.
No, I work for Artco. I'm grateful when I find a mistake. Yeah, it says here. Yeah, this is incorrect. It says here, it's customary but not obligatory to announce the precise time which the new moon begins to appear in Jerusalem. No, they announce Shabbat morning, the Moilad. The Moilad will be X and X time, right? Anybody ever notice that before they do Mavarach Mechidesh? So it's not where the new moon will appear. It's where the new lunar cycle begins. The new lunar cycle begins when the moon moves off dead center between the sun and the earth. You still can't see it usually for another 24 hours. So it's not when you can see the new moon, but rather when the new cycle begins as an astronomical phenomenon, which, you know, the sliver of the moon will not be large enough to see for at least 6 hours and usually 24 hours. Okay? So this is a mistake in the art school theory. So in any event, so if the Molad of the day that's supposed to be Rosh Hashanah comes out after noon in Jerusalem, for reasons which are a little bit complex, you have to push off Rosh Hashanah till the next day. So that year, Rosh Hashanah, you had a situation like that, although it's a little bit even more complicated than that, but let's, for simplicity's sake, that kind of Molad, it's called the Molad Zaken. It's an old Molad, meaning it happens too late in the day. So it's such a situation, and Rosh Hashanah was supposed to come out on a Tuesday, but it was a Molad Zaken situation, and Rosh Hashanah can't come out on a Wednesday, so everybody was anticipating that Rosh Hashanah would come out the following year on Thursday. So both Cheshvan and Kislev that year would be 30-day months in order to push off the following Rosh Hashanah out by 2 days. So Rabbi Aaron Meir said, no, there's actually a grace period of 642 halakim, which is approximately 40 minutes. So, and this next Rosh Hashanah falls within that grace period. And therefore, we don't have to push it off, so therefore both Cheshvan and Kislev this coming year will be chaser, will be 29-day months, so Rosh Hashanah will actually come out on Tuesday. Everybody gets that, more or less? Does anybody not get that and want to repeat it? No? Okay, so you didn't get it, but you don't want to repeat it. Fine. So that already became an issue the following Pesach, right? Because it's the discussion of Kislev of the month, so therefore there was a discrepancy following Pesach. So I wrote an article once about this topic and what the issues possibly might have been reconstructing the lumbus involved. But Rabbi Remeir had a very strong a claim, which harks back to what we were speaking about last week. He said, listen, the halacha is that the Molad is dependent on the land of Israel. I mean, not the Molad. The Kiddush of the Ruach. Right? So the Hillel Sheni had to make Ruach for all time because there was Smuchim in Eretz Yisrael, and they were last guys to have real Smicha, and they had to, therefore, anticipate all the coming Rosh Chodashim and say that they're sanctified on their basis of their Zeto. So the Ruach has to be terminated in Eretz Yisrael, not in Chutz Lorez. And as we mentioned last week, the Rambam, the famous Rambam, who says that if there aren't 10 Jews in the land of Israel, the entire Jewish calendar collapses. So the Rambam said, even if I'm wrong, I'm right. Because the Ruach is determined by the sages who are in the land of Israel. That's me, not you. The Tzaddikim was in Bavel. So therefore, he said, regardless of whether you agree with me or not, tough luck. So the Tzadikon came along with this famous shita, this famous approach, which is that the Ruach was given to Moshe Rabbeinu and Har Sinai in its totality. This is not something which we made up or was actually underneath our jurisdiction, but rather something which was given to Moshe Rabbeinu, and we are not entitled to deviate from it even in Eretz Yisrael. And there's the principle of Molad Zaken. That principle of Molad Zaken was given to Moshe Rabbeinu at Har Sinai. So the Rambam writes about this approach. I should say the Rambam we now know writes about this approach, because this entire issue only became clarified or not well known after they opened up the Cairo Gniza. The Cairo Gniza was opened up in the 1800s, and it was opened up by a fellow named Wertheimer. And there was another fellow named Solomon Schechter. You guys know who Solomon Schechter was? So he came after Wertheimer opened up the Gniza, and he stole all the documents and brought them back to Cambridge in England with him, where he led the project in the library and published them and became very famous, and actually got a job in New York as the head of Jewish Theological Seminary. But before Solomon Schechter stole the documents, was the guy Wertheimer from Yerushalayim opened it up and started publishing them. So these documents in the Cairo Gniza were there for thousands of years. I shouldn't say thousands. Thousand years. They went because what happened when people had old documents and old manuscripts, they can't wait to put them in the Seamus, right? The Seamus is the Gniza, place where you put the old documents. And I guess, you know, nowadays the custom is to bury them. I guess back then they just left it. You know, they left it in this big room and piled stuff on top and top and top. So eventually in the 1800s they opened up and they found amazing stuff in there, including the Rambam's own handwriting. And they found actually letters of the Rambam in the Rambam's own handwriting, his emendations on Mishneh Torah, where he corrected himself when he made mistakes and stuff like that. So among the things they found is this correspondence back and forth between Israel and Babel concerning this whole episode in the 920s, which really wasn't well known until that period. So the Rambam might said Rav Zadigon really didn't believe what he was saying. He just said it because he wants to win the debate. So the question is, according to the Rambam, what exactly would be the halacha? Was Rav Aaron Meir right? It seems to me that there was a more fundamental issue involved here, which is, to what extent is the Gemara the ultimate authority? Now, the Gemara didn't give this grace period, which Rav Aaron Meir asserted. He asserted you have a grace period of 642 halakim, which is 642 over 1,080 of an hour, about 40 minutes. It doesn't appear in the Gemara. So Rav Zadigon was really asserting the supremacy of the Talmud, saying after the Talmud, you can't argue anymore. Even in Eretz Yisrael, this is the supreme and final body of knowledge in Judaism. And Rav Aaron Meir said, no, it's still open. I can still come afterwards and tell you what my perspective is, and it will carry the day because I am in Eretz Yisrael. So Rav Zadigon won. How did Rav Zadigon win this argument? Rav Aaron Meir died. That was very convenient. He died we don't know exactly when, but he died between the year 923 and 927, because when this problem comes, it comes bunched up, and then it goes away for a couple hundred years. So it happened like, there are a few good years, like, close together.
We go to
And the last time it happened was in the 1840s, and nothing major happened then, and next time it happened is, I think towards the end of this century. So but in any event, there's no the thing. We're probably going to one, yeah, by default.
Well, how does into this argument about the calendar? How does it kind of tie into the standard the revival of shofar and shabbos that is called on the Shabbat in the
But I don't know if it ties in at all, because in order to have a Shofar Yerushalayim, we understand the problem. Well, let me give a little background. In the 1800s, there was a rabbi named Rabbi Akiva Yosef Schlesinger. Akiva Yosef Schlesinger was one of the early Neturei Karta. Before the Neturei Karta, he was Neturei Karta. He was one of the big zealots in Jerusalem in the 1840s, right? 1870s, whatever. Mid to latter part of the 1800s. Diamonds are no Zionists yet, right? So he didn't actually. He opposed lots of other kind of people, and he was a very radical kind of guy. He was a very cool fellow. So one thing he decided, there's a law that we don't blow shofar in Rosh Hashanah. But the Rif, one of the Rishonim, says that, you know, the Gemara Rosh Hashanah says that if you can blow shofar in the Sanhedrin. You had a Sanhedrin, like in Yavne, you blow Rosh Hashanah Shofar in the Sanhedrin in on Rosh Hashanah. The reason being that the real reason of blow Shofar is because you're afraid you'll carry. But the Dayanim, they're more careful. They'll know not to carry the Shofar out in public in Rosh Hashanah. So the Rit says, one of the Rishonim says, it's not just in a Sanhedrin, but in any Beis Din. So Rabbi Akiva, Yosef Shlesinger, they decided, okay, we're going to form a in our Beis Din, in Yerushalayim, we're going to blow Shofar on Rosh Hashanah, which had come down on Shabbos. Because he had a Beis Din, and it was in, I think it says, in, if I'm not mistaken, it has to be either Yerushalayim or Yavne. In other words, it's not in any city, right? In a Beis Din in Yerushalayim or Beis Din in Yavne, you have to supplant Yerushalayim to the destruction of the Beis Din Mikdash, you can blow Shofar on Rosh Hashanah when it comes out on Shabbos. So we actually 1 year blew Shofar on Rosh Hashanah, which came out on Shabbos. But all the Gedolim of Yerushalayim boycotted him. Except for a couple who didn't go inside to hear the Shofar, they stood outside and listened, since they didn't want to actually, you know, make a show of agreeing with him. So, but they actually, because they held that it's only when there's an actual Sanhedrin, not just a generic basis. So that issue really is, once we know which day is Rosh Hashanah, and it comes on the Shabbos, whether we can still in our day and age blow in a Beis Din or not blow in a Beis Din. But it's not a directly related issue to that issue from before. Okay? The period of the Gaonim comes to an end, in the, as I said, in the mid-1000s. In the mid-1000s, that's when the Persian kingdom is overrun by some other new dynasty, I don't remember who, and basically the period of the Gaonim comes to an end. You know, it's not Babylon, it's overrun by the Persians, that's what it is. And the period comes to an end, and that is when already the Rishonim take over, were mostly not in Babel, but rather in Europe and in Africa. As a matter of fact, since that time, Babel is really, in Judaism, is really off the map. The only person we have on the map from Babel is way later. In the 1800s, we have the Ben Yishchai. So until then, really, Babel is off the map in terms of Judaism.
And
Rav Ovadia.
I'm
sorry? Well, I'm saying until the Ben Yishchai. Afterwards, there are other people. But until the Ben Yishchai was in the mid-1800s, really, Babel is off the map. There's a story which I mentioned last year, but I want to mention it again, going, and we'll go pick up on the period of the story next week, of the four captives who were taken into captivity and then went and spread Judaism throughout the world. And that was in the year,
let's see if I can find that there.
Jesus was probably,
what?
It was a non-true story there, right?
Well, there's a question whether the story is true or not, but it's a good story anyway. 955. Four great Talmudic scholars are said to have left Bari, Italy, on a journey across the Mediterranean to collect money for charity. What else? They were already collecting back then. When they were captured by a Spanish warship. One of them, Rabbi Khushil, the father of Rabbi Hananel, was sold in North Africa, went to Kairouan, in Tunisia, Rabbi Moshe, who was Shabbos' wife and young son, who was sold with his son, Rabbi Hanoichan, in Spain, right in Cordoba, where he was appointed head of the local yeshiva, and that, I think he was one of the ancestors of the Rambam. Then Ismael was sold in Alexandria, and then went to Cairo, and the fourth one, we don't know. The fourth one's name and location is not recorded. In any event, these four scholars, each in their respective locations, raised the level of scholarship and transformed local style in a remarkable way. He says, this is a very interesting point, the Talmud scholars of Italy, from where they had come, were quite independent from the Gaonim of Babel. Their style of scholarship was based on their own logical deductions from the Talmud, as distinct from the Babylonian adherence to directly transferred tradition. They also tended to rely on the scholars and the tradition of Eretz Yisrael, which is under the same Roman government as Italy and most of Europe, Ashkenaz. So therefore, it can't be 100% correct, because one went to Spain, didn't change Spain from being Spars to Ashkenaz. But the assertion is that Nusach Ashkenaz came up from Italy and spread into Europe, whereas Nusach Spars came around North Africa with the Moorish conquest, came into Spain, where it actually became known as Spars, and then after the expulsion spread to wherever the Jews went. So you have two independent traditions which are vying for supremacy in the Jewish world. The Babylonian tradition, which spreads around North Africa to New Spain, and the Ashkenazic tradition, whatever became the Ashkenazic tradition, which spreads up the boot of Italy into Germany, northern France, and so on and so forth, and that sets the stage for the Middle Ages. Like I said before, recent archival findings pose questions for this account. of how scholars arrived in these places. But nevertheless, it's a nice story, and why not? Okay, I'll stop here for tonight. Again, I'm finished here tomorrow night in Amy Apple.
How did the Center of Jewish Life from Babel to Europe?
Because Matt Babel
was to Europe, or?
No, they were killed. They died out. There was
the last two